This is where normal comes to die. Mediocrity meets its final demise, and the status quo is unabashedly dismantled. Welcome to Reinvention Radio. Now, here's your host, Steve Ulscher.
Welcome to another edition of Reinvention Radio. Hope everyone is doing great today, and I'm super excited for today's episode, and let's just jump right into this. If you're not familiar with this man, who many consider to be pretty much the baddest man on the planet, then you probably should be. And this is Jesse Elder, and Jesse and I met fairly recently, and you know how you just kind of connect with somebody. You know, just you see somebody and you're just like, damn, that is somebody that I need to chat with. I need to get to know better. And Jesse was one of those guys. And so we had a chance to meet in Los Angeles recently at an event there that there were some pretty cool cats at. But Jesse really stood, I mean, literally and figuratively stood stood above the crowd there in terms of someone that I was just like, man, this dude is badass. So rather than me tell you Jesse's story, and it's just, man, it's a pretty amazing story. Jess, do you mind sharing with everybody here just kind of where you came from and where that puts you today in terms of the work that you're doing and just kind of the impact you're having?
Absolutely, man. And it's one of the things that I think you're doing, and I feel like we're both kind of coming from a similar genesis of our work. I just saw so many things that were being done totally ineffectively. And I realize now I can trace that back to shit that happened when I was growing up and perspective that I was just really fortunate to have been given. And so I'm the oldest of five. I was one of those homeschooled kids, you know, in the 80s, and I've never taken a test. And what that meant is that I was only doing stuff that I was really interested in. And I developed an incredibly low tolerance for things that didn't totally fire me up. And so that led to me training martial arts as a kid, and then teaching martial arts, and then fighting and doing these like underground bar fights, and then eventually opening a school. And throughout that entire process, I just kept seeing people doing things that were either they were doing it because they felt like they should be doing it, or they were copying somebody who wasn't totally inspired, and yet they were just trying to, you know, accumulate a bunch of tactics or just find a bunch of stuff that, you know, hopefully they'd patch together and it'd work. And my thing was always like, how fired up are you about this? And if it wasn't for the money, would you still be doing things the way you're doing it? And I just really became, quite frankly, frustrated in my own experience of not feeling like I had traction and I couldn't make things work the way I wanted to. And so I just really started paying attention to what worked and what didn't. And I just kind of just determined myself to fail as fast as possible. And it's kind of a training metaphor that there's only so many mistakes you can make. You know, you're going to go and learn a technique in martial arts. You're going to learn a submission in jiu-jitsu, or you're going to learn a combination for your striking. And of course, you're going to suck. Of course, you're going to be terrible at it. But I always had this figure in my mind of 100 mistakes. I figure I have 100 mistakes in me. And if I can just get those mistakes out of the way as quick as possible, by the time the mistake counter reaches zero, I'll have a level of proficiency. And I just kind of developed this fuck it attitude to failure, and I wasn't worried about it. And that resulted in some really cool things.
Yeah, man, you'll probably appreciate, you know, there's obviously a lot of different ways that people look at failure and different definitions. Mine, here's what I preach. I preach is that failure is success with an unintended ending. So, you know, it's not exactly that you're a fucking failure. It's just that, you know, things didn't exactly go to plan. And I mean, look, reality is things never go as good as you hope or as poorly as you fear anyway. But like you said, man, it's just, you know, fail fast. And I mean, that resonates with me so deeply. And there's a lot, you know, I was just thinking about what the hell. I mean, I got Jesse here. I want to talk, man, you know, and there were so many different ways I could take this. But one of the things that I want to start with is just, you know, kind of reinventing this whole education process, right? Because I've always, well, not always, but more recently, you know, I've really been under the opinion that college is absolutely the single worst investment that a parent can make. Now, you know, from a student perspective, if they know exactly what they want to do and, you know, they go to pursue that, so be it. But, you know, from a parental perspective, I mean, you're really just taking them out of that sheltered environment of getting the bottle from the bar, from their mom to getting the bottle from the bartender, right? So, I mean, it's just like, you know, it's a really poor ROI. And, you know, the only return that most parents end up with is their kid coming back home. You know, so it's like, that's not exactly the ROI they had in mind. Now, you were homeschooled, and, you know, frankly, there's a lot of stigma that goes hand in hand with homeschooling, and you know, you're socially inept, you know, you're dumb as a box of rocks, you know, you sat around watching TV, you know, you didn't do anything to really learn, and yet, you're one of the most socially, shall we say, capable people that I've come across. And so, I mean, how do you balance sort of the critics who talk about education and homeschooling, you know, with your own experience?
Well, that's a great question. And I appreciate the statement. I would argue a little bit that I am still completely socially inept at points. And so maybe there's something there, but the thing is that, number one, to your comment about college education, I can't speak from experience because I never went. And I do know that there are people who went and had a great experience. There are people who, went and had a terrible experience. There are people who never went. My take on it is this. If we just look at the word education, what education actually means, it comes from the Latin term educa, which means to draw forth from within. So true education is an inside-out process. It's a blooming of inspiration. It's this irresistible attraction that we have to stimulus that interests us, which then calls forth something much more powerful. And there's nothing like a human being to do that shit. There's nothing else that we know of that has the ability to take in all the sensory input, alchemize it, synthesize it, upgrade it, and convert it into value. Human beings are the only things that we know of that have that ability. So to someone who says, well, homeschooling sucks, cool, they're right. They are absolutely right given their experience. And to people that say college is wonderful, cool, they're right given their experience. It's just that most people don't actually make statements based on their experience. They make statements based on other people's opinions or other people's experiences or other people's interpretations. And one of my greatest missions in life is completely just destroying those filters and helping bring people to be present to their own experience, because that's the only one that matters.
Yeah, and you know, it's such a great point too, because I firmly believe that it's incredibly easy to be a critic and so hard to be a creator. And you know, the reality is that, you know, the people who are talking about homeschooling, and you know, it's probably not a good alternative if you're looking at, you know, what your options are. I mean, these are people who probably, you know, I mean, reality is they probably not only weren't homeschooled, but they probably don't know anybody who was. You know, and let's be honest here. I mean, when we talk about college, you know, these aren't places of higher education. I mean, though you certainly get educated to, you know, in large measure. I mean, it's that college campus is a business, and it's a business that's churning out millions of dollars a year. So, you know, of course, those folks are going to be behind that messaging of, you know, you have to have traditional education in order to thrive. And I mean, and of course, we're seeing more and more of this, but you're certainly a shining example of the personification of someone who has done exceptionally well in, you know, both the physical, emotional, spiritual, and financial realms, you know, without ever setting foot on that campus.
Well, I would say that's available for anybody who, number one, can learn to pay attention. And really pay attention. It's the ultimate currency that we have as human beings, is our attention. And whatever we give our attention to will multiply. And I didn't have any choice, really. I mean, I didn't get my GED. I didn't go to school. I did get my driver's license. That was the formal test that I've taken in my life. And I passed that successfully. But I just learned to pay attention to the things that mattered to me. And what mattered to me when I was 17, 18, 19 years old, girls mattered, but I had terrible social skills back then. So that was kind of off the table at that point. So I put all my energy into teaching. And what mattered to me was how many students are in class, how many of them are making progress and testing, and how good are they? Like, are they really getting good? And so I just began to measure that, and I began to count people that weren't in class, and I began to call them and say, hey, we miss you, and all these things that now, you know, I mean, I have people that say, oh my God, that was genius marketing. And I don't know, man. Today I call that gas factor. Give a shit. Like, do you actually give a shit about the people that you're serving?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So take me back through the martial arts days, because, you know, you started when you were 9. What discipline did you start in, and what have you done over the years?
Sure. I started in Harlingen, Texas, actually, in the Valley in South Texas. I was 9 years old. My instructor's name was Mr. Reed Hobbs, and I will never forget that man. He was terrifying, mm-hmm. and I loved him, and I respected him, and he really gave me a start.
And so what was that discipline?
In Taekwondo.
In Taekwondo. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
And so you worked your way up through the Taekwondo ranks, and so at what age did you actually start teaching? You probably started teaching some younger kids first, right?
Actually, it was kind of a lateral shift. I had moved to San Antonio, was a little bit older. I was 14, I guess 15 years old, and I had changed schools, and you know, we were in a different city, and I had an instructor there who was awesome. I mean, he really just challenged me, and he motivated me, and at the same time, he created space to have me start assisting. And it was, you know, anybody that's ever made this jump knows what it's like. And it's almost a joke in the martial arts industry that, you know, you do the warm up on Monday, and by Saturday you have keys to the school. And
or if you come to 50 classes, you get your black belt.
Right. And so I was just really fortunate that I had an instructor who was more than willing to kind of step out of the teaching. And, you know, he had other stuff that he was interested in. That was cool. What it really gave me was an incredible opportunity and a chance to have a lot of responsibility at an early age. So I just made a lateral shift into all the classes. So I was working with kids and working with adults. And that was a real learning experience for me, thinking, you know, here I am, this 15-year-old kid, 16, 17 years old, and I'm teaching doctors and lawyers and, you know, people that I perceived as successful in the real world. You know, why the hell should they listen to me? And I just made up for that insecurity with intensity. And I just did everything I can to just, you know, give them the best possible workout and really challenge them physically. And that actually, they loved it. And they started bringing more and more of their professional friends. And you know, by the time I was 19, 20 years old, I could teach in front of anybody. It didn't matter who they were.
So at what point did you start getting into the underground MMA circuit? How old were you when you started just going for the no holds barred stuff?
Yeah, I had one of my first business mentors. His name is Steve Doss. He had a school in Austin, and he was very successful in his school, and he would fly out to train to the Gracies right before the first UFC. Hmm. So he actually sent me a video of this old, you know, Gracie in action videotape right before UFC 1. So this is like, you know, I was like 20 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, watch this skinny Brazilian guy. He's going to beat everybody. I was like, no way. So he comes out, of course, always just destroys everybody. And that's when I started training jiu-jitsu. I guess I was about 20.
And I got to tell you, dude, I'm jealous as fuck, because I've been training in Brazilian jiu-jitsu for 15 years now. And I trained under Carlson Gracie, senior before the old man passed, and his son. And there's one thing you can't teach anyone to do or be in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and that's to be tall and have long limbs. And so I'm a short little fuck, stocky, you know, like my arms, I can barely touch, you know, like my nose, let alone the floor, let alone put, you know, if you're trying to picture Jesse, picture like a 6'4", 3% body fat, like long limb dude. And if you do Brazilian jiu-jitsu, that is like the prototype body, because it's all about, you know, control, and you control with your arms, you control your legs, you control with your body. But man, I gotta tell you, dude, I'm so jealous of your build, because it's just, I mean, in Brazilian jiu-jitsu and even in Taekwondo, just, you know, to be able to have that reach, to be able to, you know, just use that length to your advantage. I mean, it's just, man, I gotta tell you, I'm just so jealous.
Well, I have to give, I guess, credit to my parents for
the genes.
Yeah, there you go. well, it's interesting you say that, because growing up, I was super self-conscious. I was just very, very body conscious, because I was skinny and, you know, I guess homeschooling, you don't get as much of the schoolyard interaction. But man, I didn't even want to wear bathing. I didn't want to wear shorts when I was a kid because I was so just self-conscious. And so it's funny now that, you know, as time goes on, what was a total emotional liability actually is something that becomes a benefit. And I think that there are, I think life is full of those. Renee Aria, who we saw at the event that you and I met, she's just got this brilliant story about flipping your flaws. Mm-hmm. And I mean, what a powerful concept. So I appreciate that. And I'll tell you that, you know, it wasn't always that way. So you just kind of take what you got and find something that you can make better.
So you started watching this UFC stuff, and then, you know, your boss, your mentor, what was this guy to you? He was your business.
He was one of my first business mentors. He was the first person ever taught me how to answer the phone properly. First person ever taught me how to ask for an enrollment fee.
And he said, "Jesse, stuttering. I've got $500 here, man. I'm going to sponsor you, and to get that $500, I want you to go in the ring, and you know, you're not going to have any gear on." But just go, and basically whoever leaves the ring wins. So, you know,
that was about three steps prior to that conversation. he told me, he said, "Hey, come up to Austin, we'll start training." So he started showing me some stuff, and I loved it because it was so hard. It was so alien to what I'd always been told. I'd always been told, well, if a guy tries to take you down, just sidekick him, and if he takes you down, then, you know, go back and work on your sidekick.
Then grab his nuts and bite him like a little girl.
Yeah. I'm like, where's the art? And there's no art in that. So I was loving learning. And Mr. Doss, being a great coach and just a great mentor, he sent me a flyer that was for this this thing in Austin, and it was called the No Games Competition. And it was kind of a little jab at all the, you know, the hokey, you know, martial arts tournaments that were going on, and it was submission. And he said, "You ought to compete in the submission, this tournament." And immediately I had just this total fear. And I thought, "Oh gosh, you know, I've only done a couple of classes and I don't know. And he told me, he said, "What's the worst that's going to happen? The worst that's going to happen is you're going to tap out or somebody's going to choke you out. And, you know, then you learn." So he really inspired
me. That's completely inaccurate. He was lying to you. the worst that can happen is you'd fucking die.
I'm glad that I took his comment at face value. I jumped in there, had two matches, won both of them, and next thing I know, I got this trophy. And that really did a lot for my confidence. And it also taught me a huge lesson about fear. And, you know, there's two kinds of fear. There's rational and irrational. And rational fears keep us alive, but irrational fears, man, that shit keeps us from living. And so that was a really, really powerful thing. So fast forward, I kept training and I really discovered the value of self-education also, and really investing money to go to people who had the answers, not just putting the time in. And so I started just training and loving it. And next thing I know, I'm bouncing at this nightclub in San Antonio in the months prior to opening my school. And UFC is really popular. The club is kind of dead on Thursday nights. So everybody
knows how to fight, right?
Steve, here's the best part. They had two chalkboards by the bar. One had the drink specials, and the one next to it had a list to sign up to fight. And people frequently took advantage of those in that order.
Yeah, exactly. So, So I'll go down the specials, and then let's see, one, two, three. Okay. Three drink specials. I will be third on the list. Got it.
I'm feeling good. My skills are high. So I signed up to fight. I didn't take advantage of the drink specials. I wasn't drinking at all at that time. But I signed up to fight, and I thought, you know, this is either going to be horrible or it's going to be fantastic, and either way, it's going to make a hell of a story.
Yeah.
So signed up to fight.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, it's interesting, man, because, you know, and as we kind of bring it back to the work that you're doing today, you know, the fear that you have before you fight, I mean, is that's both rational and irrational in
Completely.
A lot of ways.
Perfect.
But, you know, the God's honest truth, man, is that I am sure that the experience of getting into that ring and knowing that there's really no turning back, and how you respond to that first kick in the face, you know, is truly how you probably respond in life, no?
It is. It really is. And I think it's even in addition to that, it's how you train. Because there was guys that got in that ring that were completely untrained, and the moment they got touched or grabbed or taken down, you know, all their bravado and confidence went out the window. And so you could really tell who somebody was, not by how they fought, but by how they trained. And then the training is what determined how they showed up in the ring.
Gotcha. And so so going back to that first sign up, you ended up, was that the night you won both fights, or was that a different, occasion?
It was a different thing. I had done that submission tournament, which then gave me the confidence to enter this other one. And, you know, primarily because, you know, in the land of the blind,
that's right.
The one-eyed man is king. And that was me. I was the one-eyed king because I knew more jiu-jitsu than anybody else. In addition to that, I had pretty good striking skills. But these guys were just all over the place, man. They had street fighters signing up. They had boxers. It was like a little mini UFC back in the early days.
You know, the first rule of San Antonio is you don't talk about San Antonio. Or Austin, yeah, or wherever you were at that point.
Exactly. So it was a great experience. I won the first fight by submission, and then the second guy that I fought, he'd never actually been kicked before, and so.
You know, they say the fastest way to turn a black belt into a white belt.
Yes.
To hit him in the jaw.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's the jiu-jitsu saying, right? You know, yeah. take a black belt and punch him, he becomes a brown belt.
Exactly. Punch him again, he's a purple belt. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Let's we're going to take a quick break here on Reinvention Radio, and you know, Jesse is kind enough to spend a little bit of time with us here today, and it's going to get real interesting here. So stick around. We'll be right back after this.
One person has the power to change the world, impact millions of lives, and leave a legacy for lifetimes to come. That person is you. In the New York Times bestseller, What Is Your What?, Steve Ulcher, award-winning author and founder of the Reinvention Workshop, reveals his proven process that has helped thousands of men and women discover, share, and monetize the one thing they were born to do. Grab your free copy now at www.whatisyourwhat.com/free. That's www.whatisyourwhat.com/free.
All right, thanks for sticking with us, and got Jesse Elder here with me today. And I got to tell you, talk about somebody literally dismantling the status quo. I mean, you were physically dismantling it in your youth, and now you're really sort of dismantling, you know, people's brains, if you will, in terms of how you get them to think about life and business and so on. But just kind of going back to, and we don't have to keep, you know, beating the horse here as far as the MMA stuff. I just think it's super cool, you know, that is part of your history, part of your background. And just to quickly close the gap on this, I mean, Jesse went on to open his own school, a string of schools. Would you have 7 or 8 schools at one point?
Right, right. We were part of a larger organization, and I had business partners that were aligned with that. And at the time that I sold the business and sold my shares in all the schools, we had 8 locations, and then we had a consulting company also. We were sharing our stuff with other people.
Mm-hmm. And so you ended up going into the business of helping martial arts school owners because you saw, you know, and this is part of what I talk about quite a bit is, you know, we need to just line up Oprah and everybody else and just slap them, you know, for saying that whole, you know, do what you love and the money will follow thing, because, you know, I mean, we know that that's bullshit. We know it doesn't work that way. And one of the things that you found out quite quickly, you know, it was that, you know, you could have a love for martial arts and you could be a damn good teacher, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be a phenomenal school owner. I mean, they don't correlate. And so, you know, you could look at that in any realm, whether it's cooking or gardening or, you know, finance, I mean, whatever it might be. I mean, how do you help people determine whether or not they should take that, let's just use martial arts as an example here. You know, how do you go from the mat to teaching to then having your own place? How do you help people determine if, in fact, that's something they should even think about? Not necessarily martial arts, but just in general.
Sure. Steve, that's a brilliant setup. And I agree with you 100% that there's this myth that says if you just do what you love, the money will follow. And I can sum it up for everybody listening to this in probably 18 seconds. The golden rule do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The golden rule will absolutely make you happy. But the platinum rule is what will make you wealthy. And the platinum rule is do unto others as they would have done unto them.
Do unto others as they would have done unto them.
Okay, the difference is the golden rule is treat other people the way that you would want to be treated, which is a nice foundational philosophy. And I'm not going to uproot, you know, most of the world's major religions with a single statement to say that's bullshit, but it's incomplete. If we do unto others as we would have done unto us, then that means that I, at this time of this recording, I love hamburgers. But I was a vegetarian for 13 years. So if I love hamburgers and I come to you and say, hey, Steve, let's go out and get a hamburger, or I make you a hamburger, well, what if you happen to be not eating hamburgers? Then it's a total backfire. And I did what I thought was right because that's what I would want done to me. But it's totally incomplete because it's not coming from a place of service. It's not coming from a place of understanding or empathy or that gas factor. Give a shit about people. That means you have to know what they want, not what you want. And so this whole make, you know, do what you love and the money will follow. There is tremendous power to that. It's just that it's incomplete. And so if we can get both parts down, yes, find out what you love to do more than anything, so much that you would pay to do it. That was me when I was a kid, teenager, teaching martial arts. I was actually paying, or my parents at that time were paying tuition, and I was doing all the classes. So I was paying to play. And then eventually you cross that line and you get paid to play. So I think that that's an essential ingredient. You have to find something that you love to do so much that you would do it for free or even pay to do it.
Yeah, but then how do you make? Does everybody have that? You know, I mean,
absolutely, without question.
With you, are you certain? I mean, because it's just like, you know, there are some people, man. It was just like, you know, I do the work around helping people figure out this whole what thing, right? And it's just like I kind of see the deer in the headlights a lot. And so, I mean, do you think it's within everybody?
I don't think it is. I know it is. I also know.
I lost you there.
I don't think it is. I know it is.
There you go. You're back. Yay. you know it is. Okay, cool.
Because here's the thing. Because the reason people have a challenging time connecting with that is because they were never shown, not never, but rarely. Rarely are we shown that it's okay to want what we want.
Yeah, but I mean, how do you reconcile? I mean, people are going to sit here and say, yeah, I mean, this is something I really love to do. And I mean, you know, I could see doing this, but, you know, I don't see how I could make money doing that. And so how do you kind of reconcile the whole money part of the equation with, you know, how people are naturally wired to excel?
Well, there's three steps to close that gap. Number one, if there's something you really love to do, but you're not that good at it, then chances of you getting paid are slim to none. So you may like doing something, but that like has to become a passion. It's got to become something that you can absolutely obsess over and lose yourself in at times. Because when that happens, eventually there's going to be another person who's going to notice how good you are, and they're going to say, how did you get so good? And if people aren't noticing that, then there's a great chance that you're not that good yet.
So that, man, it's kind of that Malcolm Gladwell thing, no? The 10,000-hour rules. I mean, are you saying somebody's got to have that kind of time into it, or what? I mean,
I disagree. I disagree with the 10,000 hours. It doesn't take 10. It does not take 10,000 hours. But it does have to have. It must be something that you are so passionate about that you can latch onto it, and it inspires you. Now, until that happens, what you've got to do, your brain is a lot like an untrained puppy. You got to socialize it. You got to get it around lots of different experiences so that you can then figure out what it is that you really want to do. I mean, my own career or business today, my entire lifestyle combines all of the aspects of everything that I ever wanted to be or do growing up.
Yeah, but you're one of the lucky ones. I mean,
no,
it's like,
no, Steve, I'm not.
No, not. I mean, come on, man. Really? See, that's the thing, right? It's like, you know, people say, you know, man, you've got it great. And
I do.
You're lucky. And, you know, Jesse, I mean, you've got the ideal life, you know, but that's great for you, man. But, you know, I got this 9-to-5 gig. It ain't happening for me.
Right. Then I would say that they completely deserve to continue to experience the consequence of their choices. And that's all that luck is. Luck is the momentum of choice.
So take us through. So you've got, so that was sort of step one there, and you've got two other ways to bridge that gap, you said.
Right. So step one is you've got to find something that you're totally passionate about, and that can take time. That can take practice. It can take trying lots of things that you don't like so that you can find what you do like that much more clearly. And that's cool. That process by itself can be enjoyable.
So that explains step one. Why I dated then the Filipinos, the Asians, the Latins, and the whites, and ended up with the Latins. Okay, I get it.
You got to go through contrast, man. but then here's the second part. The second part is you find a way that creates value for other people. You look for people's problems. You look for issues that they're having that you used to have. And then you go and say, hey, I used to have the same thing, now I don't, or I used to have the same issue and now I don't, or I used to have that problem and now I don't, then I'd be happy to share it with you.
So does that kind of go back to, you know, one of the expressions that I love, man, is, you know, to a second grader, a fifth grader is a god, you know, mm-hmm. And it's just like, is that kind of how you would recommend people get started is, you know, there's always going to be someone a couple of steps behind you and miles behind you and, of course, miles in front of you.
Yes.
But would you recommend just getting started with those that you're probably a couple steps behind you?
Absolutely. The best sales letter that anybody can write, maybe not the best, but one of the best ways to write a sales letter is go back in time. Write a letter to yourself 3 years ago.
So, okay, so what would that sound like? I mean, here I am, I'm doing my 9-to-5, I'm not really digging it, but I know that, I could, maybe I'd be a phenomenal business coach, right? I've got my instinctually, I could help people. How do you, that's where I think people get thrown off, man, is like, I haven't done it, so how do I do it?
Good. And this is a huge part of what I teach. I mean, we have a Facebook program called Ethical Cult Building, and that's the entire focus of the program is how do you take something that you're interested in? How do you begin to develop some momentum and a movement around it? And quite simply, the way to do that is to find what are the problems that you're dealing with and figure out how to fix it. Figure out how to overcome your own problems so that you're then speaking from a level of experience. And that could be something as simple as, I want to figure out how to build a list of 100 people. Let's say if you're in email marketing and you don't have anything. Or I want to figure out a more fun and effective way to train my dog. Or I want to figure out how can I connect with my teenager that is starting to become distant. So find a problem that you have in your own life, figure out how to fix it. And once you've done that, you become your own case study.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And then you simply there's so many easy ways to do it, but Facebook is easy or even just reaching out to friends or people that you're already in connection with and say, hey, I had this issue and it occurred to me that because I had it, maybe some other people do too. And I'm going to just have a discussion around this and I'm going to share some things that helped. If you're interested, comment in, or if you're interested, you know, I'll send you the info and we're going to have a meetup.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's that?
No, go ahead.
So you just begin to develop some momentum. And what happens is you're actually upgrading your identity. You're upgrading your identity from being a student to being a leader.
And what's the third way to bridge that gap?
The third way is once you have some, and once you have other people that are starting to get results, then you just continue to do what you do. You create some structure around it, i.e. a curriculum or some sort of syllabus, which sounds complicated and maybe coming from the guy who's never taken a test sounds a little weird, but it is very, very easy to build curriculum based on something you're passionate about and something that helps people, step one and two. And then you just simply invite people to join. Mm-hmm. Say, we're going to have this conversation. We're going to have this however many sessions, and if you're tired of dealing with A, B, and C and you want to have X, Y, and Z instead, here's how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And you simply make an invitation and invite people to join you.
Gotcha. So you were just and I appreciate you joining me today because I know you're in a faraway distant land. we broke up there just for a second, but I think what you were saying in number three was just basically once you begin to get a bit of a following, you get a bit of experience, then you, for lack of a better term here, you kind of systemize what you're doing with those people. Is that what you said, correct?
That's correct. People like structure, and it really helps their brains to kind of wrap around what it is you're doing. Mm-hmm. And this is, to this day, this is a huge part of my private work. And I work with entrepreneurs to take their vast body of experience, which they're probably too close to actually see the value in, and be able to convert that into a saleable curriculum.
So do most people charge, not nearly enough for their experience, for their perspective, for their abilities? What's kind of your take on the fee structure that a lot of people put in place?
Speaking candidly, I think that coaching or training or it's worth whatever you can repeatedly sell it for.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has very little to do with what your story or your experience or anything else. It has everything to do with your ability to help people get results and to convey those results accurately. So, there are coaches out there who I think are incredibly underpriced. And there are other coaches who I personally think are incredibly overpriced, but none of that matters really to me because I'm not paying them.
Yeah. Yeah, I got you. So, obviously, like I said at the beginning of this, there's so many different ways that I wanted to take this, and just out of respect for your time, we'll just try to keep it to under 17 hours if that's okay. but, one of the things that you talk about, is that, you firmly believe, because you got, what you call your self-mastery truths, and you talk about how your life is meant to be lived as fully as your imagination and courage will allow.
Correct.
And, there's of course the devil's advocate in me that's saying, a lot of what I imagine is illegal. So
where?
Where
is it illegal?
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. Yeah, exactly. So I just got to find out where it's legal. All right. Well,
yes.
Point well taken. So, but how many people, if you had 100 people lined up, how many people do you think out of that 100 embody this self-mastery truth?
I think that everybody embodies it 100%.
How many live it? How about that?
I would say 100%. Because if you look at the statement, your life is meant to be lived as fully as your courage and your imagination will allow. So you'll never outpace those, and you'll never underperform those. So the trick to expansion is to constantly increase your courage and constantly increase your imagination. So if you see somebody who is, and without judgment, but if somebody is living a 9 to 5, they're 25 pounds overweight, they're not completely miserable in their marriage, but they're certainly not thrilled. They are starting to have the early stages of heart disease. These are the averages. I would say that they are living 100% congruently with that self-mastery truth. They are living 100% the experience of their courage and their imagination. It's just that their courage is completely atrophied and their imagination is feeble.
So, that's kind of like life puts you there. For a lot of people, life
I totally
just beats
disagree.
You down, and you disagree.
Yeah, I love you, and I disagree. Because life doesn't do anything to you. Mm. Nothing has any inherent meaning to it. And we have the ability, moment by moment, to make choices about what we're going to focus on. We can make choices about whether something is good or bad. And this is the entire reason behind my work, is to remind people, not even to teach, because everybody knows it deep down inside, but to remind people of the incredible power of their choice. So when people will say, well, that guy's lucky, I will say, no, he's not lucky. He's experiencing the results of thousands of choices. And when somebody says, this guy is look at this thing that happened to him. No, he's experiencing the consequence of thousands of choices.
So why do you think some people have, if you will, sort of a wider threshold of courage and a bigger imagination? Is there a couple of common denominators that you see among those who, for lack of a better term, are just kind of stuck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you're really on track there. One of the biggest ones is a lack of role models.
Mm.
And it's also because we live in a society that makes people special when they exercise those things, and we call them a star or a celebrity, and that's cool. But if we can normalize that, if we can normalize the expression of personal genius, and we can look at somebody who's living an extraordinary life, and we can begin to demystify it and say, well, that's the natural, logical result of exercising your courage and your imagination. We don't think it's a miracle when somebody goes to a gym, works their ass off for a year and a half, and gets bigger muscles. We don't call that a miracle.
Call that fucking hard work.
Well, it's focus.
Focus,
and it's,
yeah.
And it's being able to have this self-selected suffering, self-selected pain. You walk into the gym, you know it's going to hurt, but you know you're better than that, you know you're stronger than that, and you know that it beats the alternative. And so
to the contrary, would you say then you have like self-selected euphoria?
Yeah, that's really, really well put. I think, all happiness is self-generated and all misery is self-inflicted. So it's all an inside job.
So how do you get somebody off the downward spiral? You know, I mean, just for years, I mean, it's like you put the grease on the bottom of the boots from the mountaintop and you just can't stop the slide.
Well, in that case, I would say just hang on because it'll be over soon. In other words, something's going to happen in that person's life to cause them to wake the fuck up and make some new choices. Mm-hmm. Or not. They may go to their grave not having made those choices, and that's fine too.
Mm-hmm.
There's nobody – so to answer the question more directly, I would never do anything to get somebody out of that because it's not my job.
Who's my ideal job client, Jesse?
Somebody who's hungry, somebody who's motivated, and somebody who is absolutely willing to do whatever it takes to get to the next level.
Yeah, man. And so do you find that most people just kind of hit bottom in some way and that's where
Yes.
they come to you? Or is it on their way up? Where are most people finding you, and like, you know, what do they need you for?
Well, that's a great question. As far as the bottom part, the bottom has to be there in order for any change to be made. But there are two ways to hit bottom. Number one, you can just sink and sink and sink and sink until you hit bottom. Or number two, you can completely, you know, you may be standing on the middle rung of the ladder, but all of a sudden, if you add 50 rungs to the top of the ladder, well, now you're at the bottom.
Yeah. And so, what do you say to people that are just, I guess, content? You know, not thrilled, not like, damn, this life is amazing, but just like, you know, I'm okay with where I am.
Cool. I would say there's tons of coaches out there that it would be awesome for you, and I'm not one of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And lastly, while we wrap here, man, give me like one kick ass success story of someone who came to you at point A and where they are now, or where they ended up at point B.
Sure. One of my favorite stories is a guy named Jamie Schreier. Jamie and I met at an event a couple of years ago, and we began to work together. And he's a successful entrepreneur. He has a couple of physical therapy clinics on the East Coast. But he knew that he really wanted to teach other people how to replicate what he'd done. And so he was just working on his messaging and his packaging and, you know, how do I do this? So we started working together. And he deserves all the credit. My job is to be the riverbanks and just kind of guide here and there. But Jamie did an amazing job taking the processes that we went through, putting his own genius and his own brand of magic into it. And he texted me actually a couple of weeks ago. He just did a live event, and he had, I think, 5 or 6 people that came to his event, and he had a $48,000 weekend.
Wow, good for him. Yep.
And he's doing exactly what he loves to do. He's making huge changes in his industry. And we just have the best fucking time when we get together. Like, he comes to town or he comes into Austin for our trainings, and it's like Christmas, man. I'm so excited.
Sweet, man. Jesse, how do people get a hold of you? Where do they find you?
Easiest way is I don't have a lot of information out there, but I'm always happy to have a conversation with someone who is interested in amplifying their results and see if or how I can help them. And the easiest way to do that is they can go to jesseelder.com/apply. And then there's a password on there. The password is choice. So jesseelder.com/apply. password is choice. And there's just a couple of questions on there that will help me to get some clarity about who they are. And then we just jump on the phone. And if I can help them, I will. And if I can't, then I'll be happy to direct them to somebody that might be able to.
Sweet. And just to clarify, it's JesseElder.
So that's right.
JesseElder.com. Yeah. Well, my man, I know I so appreciate you being on. I know that this is going to be of immense help to so many who are going to listen to this. And I got to tell you, I mean, I'm inspired by you, brother, and just keep up the amazing work, and look forward to crossing paths again real soon.
Likewise. It's been an honor, Steve. Thank you so much, man.
All right, my brother. Take care.
All right. Cheers.